What's going on, folks? Welcome to another edition of the Coop Cast. I am your host, as always, Jason Coop. And today's edition is going to be all about the ultra runner's gut. If you've been around the sport of ultra running for long enough, you know that this is an issue that completely plagues ultra runners of all different calibers during racing and also during training. And so I brought on the show today, Patrick Wilson, who is an assistant professor of exercise science and directs the Human Performance Laboratory at Old Dominion University. And he also is a registered dietitian, which is a pretty powerful 1-2 punch out there in the world of sports nutrition and sports science. I used some recent travel that I had out to the Canary Islands to the Trans Gran Canaria race, and I parlayed that into going and visiting him at Old Dominion University and sitting down and talking about a new book that he wrote that I just happened to get an advanced copy of called The Athlete's Gut. And I have to tell you, I think the book is extremely well laid out. It's going to end up being a fantastic resource, not only for ultra runners, but for all different types of athletes. So we took this conversation and we really kind of focused on three big things. Is first off, why the athlete's gut is important. It's more than just a delivery system for the food stuff that you eat. We then spent a good chunk of time, pretty much the majority of the interview, talking about how to train the gut and what we know and what we don't know about training the gut and its implications for training and for racing. And then we also talked about how psychology plays into this complex interaction of nausea and or vomiting that ends up occurring not only during racing but also during training. I think this episode is really chock full of a lot of practical tidbits that you can get and you can really readily implement tomorrow on your training run. Or if you're actually listening to this while you're training, you're probably going to end up eating a whole lot more, to be quite frank with you. So sit back, kick back, get your popcorn ready. That would be a very appropriate thing to do for a nutrition talk, getting some popcorn ready, and settle in for this conversation that I had with Patrick Wilson on the ultra runner's gut. I was thinking on the way down here about what the title is going to be. And I was going to, you know where I'm going with this, I think. And so I was going to riff off of the title of the book and just call it The Ultra Runner's Gut. But I thought to myself that when I put that title out there, ultra runners are probably going to think of like two different things. They're either going to think of like the abdominal adiposity, right, that they have, like actually having like a big gut, because, you know, ultra runners are, you know,
like the beer gut.
Yeah, they have a beer gut or something like that. Or they're going to be so narrowly focused on like how many tater tots that they can consume at the next aid station or something like that. So I don't know actually what to call in advance, but I do think it's a good like parlay into the fact that the gut, and especially in the context of an athlete, is more important than just a vehicle to consume and digest food, right?
Yeah, I mean, the gut, obviously, the main job is going to be breaking down and absorbing what you eat. I mean, that inherently is its main function. However, it's got other critical things that are going to be important in terms of an athlete being able to perform or do well. It's a site of immune defense. It's a extension of your nervous system. So undoubtedly, the way that your gut is functioning is going to have an impact well beyond the local gut itself. I mean, it's going to affect your mood. It's going to affect the way you feel. And it's potentially going to affect your risk of things like infections. So it's not just on its own. It only digests and absorbs the nutrients that you consume. It has a set of functions that are going to be critical for an athlete, including ultra runners. I mean, the other thing is that when it comes to performance, if you don't feel well, whether that be gastrointestinal distress or some other source of pain or discomfort, you're not going to be able to perform well. So just beyond, you know, the digestion and absorption aspect of the gut, how you feel and the way you perceive about the way your gut is feeling is going to have a huge impact, particularly in endurance sports and ultra sports, with respect to how you're going to perform. And that shows up clearly in the research, is that the number one reason why ultra racers drop out of races is because of gut distress. And primarily it's nausea. So even if you kind of focus and drill down, for a lot of ultra runners, that seems to be the most critical symptom in terms of causing problems, at least problems severe enough for them to actually quit a race.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons why ultra runners specifically, when they start talking about their gut or their GI system, they're going to have this like fairly narrow focus on the nausea that emanates from an ultra marathon mm-hmm. race, specifically because it is so prevalent in that sport. But as you were pointing out, it has all of these other aspects and all yeah. these other functions that are not only critical for performance, but also important for just general health.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So why don't we start to like set the table there, and let's go over specifically how like the athlete's gut is different and how it needs to function within the body, and then try to translate that into ultramarathon specifically.
I mean, in terms of differences with the average person, I mean, I think structurally there isn't necessarily a huge difference. It is the demands that especially an ultra athlete can place on their gut is going to be very different from the average person though. And that can be day-to-day training and the amount of food that an athlete is going to have to ingest to supply the energy for that training can be quite large, especially during heavy training periods or during a race. And then obviously being able to eat during exercise is not a natural thing. I mean, that's not necessarily something that's natural to humans, I think. It's a challenge for most people to consume, digest, and absorb food when they're exercising, particularly for prolonged periods of time. So an athlete's gut is going to have to be trained in a way. They have to accustom their gut to being able to handle eating, especially in larger amounts, during exercise, which really isn't a natural, I think, thing for most people, for most humans. You don't have this inclination to eat in most cases during exercise, at least the type of exercise that most people are doing. Yeah.
And you mentioned it's a big factor. I mean, we've in your book, The Athlete's Gut, mentions a study by Marty Hoffman that I actually mentioned in my book as well, mm-hmm. where they surveyed athletes after the Western States 100, I think it was Rio Del Lago as well, just to get a bigger like sample size. And the number one issue that they all encountered was nausea and or vomiting. Yeah. But to relate to the point that you made earlier about trainability, what I actually found more fascinating about that survey, and just to set the survey up a little bit for the people that are listening to this, they polled people after they'd completed either one of these races, and they asked them what affected your race performance, and you had this menu of things to choose from, and you could choose one or all mm-hmm. of them. And of course, nausea and or vomiting rose to the top of the list. But in the middle of the list was inadequately trained. And when I put my coaching hat on and I look at that, I go, wait a minute. If you're suffering from anything in an ultramarathon, you're inadequately trained for that particular stress. And one of the things that I took away from that is there's this big discrepancy between how athletes think about nausea and or vomiting, which is the category that mm-hmm. the Hoffman group was giving that particular ailment, and its trainability. And we're going to come back to that okay. in a second, because that's a fascinating area and one that I don't think we have really clear answers yeah. on. But I think, needless to say, I don't think a lot of athletes have this, they just have this gap between what is trainable and what is not, particularly when it has to do with the digestive systems yeah. and food stuff. So why don't we take it out of an athletic context for a little bit and talk a little bit more about competitive eaters, which I think is a fascinating yeah. area as well, but it demonstrates how malleable the system is.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's something I talk about a little bit in the book, because I think it's an interesting population that obviously their goal is to consume large quantities of food in a very short amount of time. Now, obviously athletes, ultra runners, that's not their goal, but you can maybe start to think about how at least some of that stuff could translate in a situation where you do have to consume more food than what you're used to, or maybe you want to naturally in a prolonged endurance event. But yeah, I mean, there's, you know, obviously people like Joey Chestnut, Kobayashi. I mean, they're eating, I think the world record, if I remember right, is about 74 hot dogs in 10 minutes, and that's with the buns. So that's about 20,000 calories. So about, you know, 7 to 10 days worth of food in a single sitting, essentially.
And they weren't born with that, let's be clear.
No, I mean, there's no way that you are born with that, entirely with that capacity to consume that amount of food. I mean, they will talk about in interviews progressively increasing the amount of food or water or fluid they consume over, you know, the weeks and months before these competitions.
It's classic progressive overload.
It is,
When you actually, yeah. I'm glad that you mentioned the interview, because I took the same thing away from some of those interviews when I see them on ESPN or whatever. I'm like, oh, that's progressive overload training.
I don't know if they periodize or if it's a block scheme or what they're doing, but yeah, they're definitely progressing it to the point where in the competition, they feel like they're at their peak to be able to, you know, consume a large amount of foodstuffs in a short amount of time. You know, the adaptations, I think, physiologically are not well understood in that population, because there really aren't actually many studies with competitive eaters.
Right.
There's one where they had a guy who's a competitive eater, basically eat as many hot dogs as he could in that amount of time. And then they compared him to a control, and they said the control had a hearty appetite, was their description of what the comparison was. They wanted somebody to compare this guy to. And they basically did an X-ray type movie analysis when he downed these hot dogs for this study. And you could just see the pictures in the journal article. I mean, it looks like there was a fireball explosion inside of his gut. I mean, it's a massive amount of food. So what you see is that they're able to accommodate really large amounts of food through maybe a greater relaxation of the stomach. But to a large extent, it seems like it's just tolerance. Like they're able to tolerate that same volume way better than anybody else could. The stomach actually doesn't quicken how fast it empties in that situation. It's just largely, it seems like it's a tolerance thing and a distension of the stomach in accommodation. So that's one example of, you know, speed eaters, how that translates to athletes. Obviously, that's a bit of a stretch, but it shows you that the gut is adaptable. What you put into it is going to have an impact on how it functions. So that naturally is going to have some sort of implication for what an athlete might do during an event, during their training, to make sure that what they're putting into their gut, they're ready for, and they've experienced before. It's not the first time they've done it.
Yeah. And although ultra runners are quite renowned for trying to eat copious quantities of food at aid station, they are not going to compare to a Joey Chestnut or any of the other competitive eaters. I mean, that's on a totally kind of on a totally another level. Okay, let's kind of bring it back to ultra running though. I like the analogy though, because it shows that some aspects, at least some, maybe not all of them, of training the gut can be analogous to just like any sort of other physical training, where your heart, you know, your heart changes with physical training, your muscles change with physical training, your ligaments change with physical training and things like that. The gut is an organ, right? Mm-hmm. And the gut, like the GI system, it's all an organ, and it can adapt depending upon what it's exposed to, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I agree. Some of the adaptations are probably nutrient specific, meaning if you put in to the diet a lot of carbohydrate or glucose, the changes in terms of like how quickly those things empty from the stomach will be specific to glucose or to carbohydrate. Some of the other adaptations, my guess is that they're just more generalized. So volume, if you put a lot of stuff into the stomach in a short amount of time, I think the perceptual changes you get with that, the greater tolerance, to a large degree has to do with just volume. It's not necessarily a nutrient specific adaptation. So there's some that are maybe just volume, then there's nutrient specific, and then there's just things perceptually that change once you become accustomed to eating things either at a greater rate or in specific situations like exercise. Yeah, the honest truth is we don't have a lot of data on the trainability of the gut specific to exercise. Most of this stuff is in other populations, and there's a pretty limited amount of research specific to athletes. How do you train the gut and does that impact performance? Yeah.
Let's not go too far down that rabbit hole yet. Let's continue to kind of like set the table, because there are different issues that athletes and that ultra marathon runners are going to kind of encounter that are specific to their GI system. And what my opinion on this is we tend to oversimplify or trivialize them all underneath this umbrella of GI distress.
Yeah, exactly.
And they can be several different, very specific things. And the reason that is important is, depending upon what flavor of GI distress you have or what type of GI distress you have, the pathway out of it, or even the trainability to make it better, can be different. So why don't you take some time and let's go over all of those different like types and then why they might be specific or not specific to ultramarathon running.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question and thought, in terms of, if you read articles, whether they be scientific articles or publications on, you know, the internet or wherever else, usually they just kind of say gut distress.
Right.
And as you're saying, they're not the same phenomena. They're sometimes different. Now, there are things that will commonly make all symptoms worse. Like if you are super dehydrated, or if you are somebody who is just overly sensitive to things in your environment, it's sort of hypersensitivity is what we call it. There are things that make most symptoms worse, but a lot of these symptoms, there are maybe specific causes, so that if you're looking to fix nausea, for example, remedies that fix abdominal cramping may not apply. And that's part of the book, you know, The Athlete's Gut. I go through in chapter 2 and go through basically every symptom you could probably imagine and talk through what are the specific causes for each of those symptoms. Sometimes they're similar and sometimes they're not. I think nausea, and this is more related to the ultra endurance community, is probably the most complex in terms of what can cause it. You can have physical stimuli. You can have chemical stimuli. I think for ultra runners, a lot of times what you see happen is that over the course of a race, as you get into the latter half, especially like a 100-mile race, the amount of things in your blood that are likely to provoke nausea in the brain go up. So you've got adrenaline, you've got glucagon, you've got arginine vasopressin, that's a water conservation hormone. You've got muscle breakdown products. You've got endotoxins, which are things that have come from the environment or now in your blood because your gut has become leaky. So it's just this stew of stuff that builds up in your blood that, particularly as the race gets into the, you know, 50 to 70 to 100-mile territory, that's why you see rates of nausea as high as 60% in 100-mile races.
And the other 40% are lying.
And the other 40%, either they don't know what nausea is, because sometimes you ask people in a study, like, are you nauseous?
Yeah, it's still perceptive, right?
And they're like, what does that mean again? So sometimes people don't know, and then sometimes people don't want to say yes when they really are. Yeah. But it's the bulk of people in an ultra race have nausea. So I think that one is probably the most complex and can be, honestly, one of the most difficult ones to really pick out what's the cause in any given situation, because you have to evaluate all those possibilities. And that's just a short list of stuff. I mean, there are other things going on nutritionally, health-wise, that can cause that problem. So then you go down, kind of, if you go down the chain, you've got reflux, regurgitation, burping. For most athletes, unless it's really severe, it generally probably isn't going to impact performance. Burping and flatulence, gas, are the two most common symptoms that athletes report, but they're usually not severe enough for them to quit a race.
No, those are badges of pride in ultra running, sure.
So those are common, very common, but not, for the most part, overly concerning for most athletes. Stomach discomfort, fullness, bloating is another one that is really common. I think behind nausea, bloating was the next most kind of severe symptom in those studies that Marty Hoffman did that athletes indicated were problematic for them. And then from there, you go more maybe into the lower gut. You've got abdominal cramping, loose stools, urge to go, number two, bloody diarrhea, bloody stool, gas, flatulence. So it kind of runs the gamut. And the point is that there are potentially different causes for each of those symptoms. It would be impossible to go through all those in a short interview and kind of talk about what are the causes. Yeah. I think maybe it's helpful to focus on, like, the nausea, for example, to a large degree, because that's the one that is most problematic for most ultra racers would be my thought.
Okay, so we'll stick on that for the most part, but needless to say, there's this whole host of other things that, you know, the prevalence in an ultra marathon run, it could be high, it could be low. I mean, even if you look at things like side stitches, and as you mentioned, diarrhea is a big, you know, can be a big issue, but it takes a, like, it's complicated to unwind all of that.
Yeah.
But I think for the kind of the remainder of this interview, the focal point is going to be specifically this like big umbrella underneath the bigger umbrella of nausea.
Yeah.
And it's incredibly complicated. And as you mentioned, there's probably a chemical basis for it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a psychological basis for
it.
There is exercise basis for it, both in terms of time and intensity. What other things are playing into this whole nausea concoction that ends up rearing its head during an ultra?
I mean, I think you hit on a few of those things. You have, especially with prolonged exercise, you're kind of struggling to supply blood to your gut, and that can act as a trigger for most symptoms, not only nausea, but for the other symptoms that I listed. That's one of those features that, or one of those things that generally makes most symptoms worse. And there's good studies to show that as you get, you know, from 10 to 20 to 60 minutes of exercise, the amount of blood flow in the gut tends to decline. And that's even in a hydrated state. So if you take an athlete who is dehydrated, that's even a smaller amount of blood that they have available to supply to their gut. So underhydration certainly can play a role if someone is well below where they probably should be in terms of their hydration status. Now, interestingly, at the same time, overhydration can actually do the same thing. If you've got fluid overload, you're hyponatremic, that extra fluid in your vascular space can kind of migrate into your brain, cause swelling that triggers nausea. So that's another known symptom of hyponatremia is nausea. It's kind of interesting that both dehydration and fluid overload from overhydrating can kind of do the same thing. You know, there's other distinguishing features you can use to determine whether someone's hyponatremic versus dehydrated, but just based on symptoms alone, sometimes it can be problematic.
Super tricky. I mean, they've tried to do that in the field for years.
Right.
Try to determine if somebody is hyponatremic, overhydrated, dehydrated, or what, you know, combination of all those can actually be. And it's very hard to do from the list of symptoms, as you mentioned.
In terms of the other sources, you know, if you're going hypoglycemic potentially, if you really have undereaten, I mean, the body's pretty good at regulating blood glucose during exercise, but you might see 10, 15% of athletes or something like that, if they're undereating, develop hypoglycemia. And that's going to trigger a further stress hormone response, your catecholamines, adrenaline, noradrenaline. And those hormones probably play a role in triggering nausea. They get it into the an area of the brain that they bind to these receptors, and those receptors communicate with another part of your brain called the vomiting center. I mean, it's not very imaginative, but that's what they kind of came up with the name. That basically tells you, okay, we may need to eject something from the body here as a way to protect it from, you know, various toxins or substances that might be harmful. So yeah, if you think about stress, other things that provoke a larger catecholamine or epinephrine, norepinephrine, adrenaline response, you tend to see more nausea in those situations. So it could be a contributing factor if an athlete is under eating carbohydrates and they're somewhat hypoglycemic. Theoretically, that could be playing a role.
So one of the confounding things here is we know what causes a lot of these nausea symptoms in the actual race. It's either over this or under that.
Yeah.
Over consumption of this, under consumption of that, over drinking fluid, under taking blah, 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 blah. But in reality, what athletes have been trying to do is they've been trying to train themselves to combat all of those over under types of scenarios. And they do that in kind of two, you'll have to excuse the food pun here. They kind of do it. There's going to be a lot of these.
There's a lot of puns in the book. Yeah, so, I mean, gosh, if you're going to write a book about
a lot of references to The Office about, too.
There is. So if you don't like The Office, maybe it's not the book for
or you.
Or you
could brush up on Your Office. You
can
binge watch it beforehand. Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, there's kind of like two flavors that athletes have, or two tracks. We'll use that analogy. I mean, two tracks that athletes have used to kind of combat this because they know it's going to be an issue. The first one is to do something in advance of the event itself. I'm going to train in some way to be able to combat all this nausea during the race. And we're going to take that issue first. The second one are more of kind of the oh shit things that happen during the race. I'm going to take, you know, the supplement, I'm going to take ginger, I'm going to try, you know, this, I'm going to do this type of, you know, acid, you know, acid reducer, you know, in the days leading up to the event and things like that. But let's talk about the training aspect first. So what started to emerge in the ultra marathon world that I want to get your take on are these two somewhat, but not completely divergent strategies. One of them is training the gut, where you're practicing your nutrition program and even something that might be above and beyond from a caloric or from a volume standpoint, more than what you're actually doing in the race. That's one strategy, actually training the gut like you would train your skeletal muscles, essentially. The other one is to train your body to utilize more fat so that you are less reliant on exogenous foodstuffs, whether it be a gel or a pizza or kind of whatever, so that you don't have to deal with as much food and drink and things like that kind of going through the system. Let's talk about the first one first. The first one I talked about first, that makes sense, right? Training the gut. What do we know about that?
So there's, you know, in terms of the exercise world, there's been a couple of studies in the last maybe 10 years that show if you repeatedly ask people to consume extra carbohydrate in their diet, either over 2 weeks or a month, what you see happen is an upregulation or an increase in their ability to utilize that exogenous carbohydrate for fuel. So if you supplement, for example, an athlete's diet with an extra, you know, 100, 200 grams of glucose per day, let's say, that's going to result in a better ability for them to absorb that glucose and then burn it for energy. Now, why does that happen? It seems like it's kind of an increase in these transporters that are in the intestine that help you take the glucose from the lumen, the hollow space, across the cell membrane into your intestinal cells and then into the blood. So if you can better absorb that glucose, it means a couple of things. Number one, you can use it, which is great. Carbohydrates, generally more efficient fuel than fat. And number two, it means it's not sitting in the gut. And if it's not sitting in the gut, it's less likely to cause symptoms. Because when you have glucose sitting in the gut, what happens is you have water that's pulled out into the lumen, that carbohydrate can get fermented later on in the colon. That equals loose stools, diarrhea, gas, bloating, generally things that are not favorable for performance. So there are at least two studies that have shown that if you supplement runners or cyclists with more carbohydrates, that they are able to better burn exogenous fuel. Now, the question is, does that automatically translate to better performance? And that's a more debatable question. The studies were generally pretty short term. So, you know, I don't know that there's a clear scientific answer on that. I think if you are going to try and consume a lot of carb during a race, then it makes total sense to train that way and to practice it and to implement that in your diet.
Yeah. And let's, before we get too far into the weeds here, let's kind of back up and go over what that actually might look like. Like you know, you mentioned 100 to 200 grams of carbohydrate in addition, but there's also studies, the one that we threw out in advance of this podcast, the Costa study, where they're consumed, what was the rate on that? 90 grams?
Basically 90 grams per hour for 2 hours.
For 2 hours, for 2 weeks. Something like that before.
Yes, it was 2 week protocol. I think they did it 4 or 5 times over the 2 weeks, something like that.
And what I'm trying to get at is if an athlete wants to train the gut, they need to know some sort of dosage to train it with it in terms of amount, just like we do with physical training.
Yeah.
We know we need to train 10 hours a week for 4 weeks or 8 weeks or whatever it is. I know that the research hasn't completely flesh this out, but what would be a reasonable strategy if an athlete says, okay, I know I'm going to have to eat in training like I'm going to do in the race, and I want and I want to essentially train the gut to absorb more food stuff. What would be a reasonable strategy for that athlete to undertake?
I guess I would probably start by telling them to take a look at what they're doing now and then gradually increase that over time. But the upper limit in terms of what you probably would try is between, you know, 60 and 90 grams, maybe 100 grams per hour during your training. So that can be, and what does that end up being, 3 or 4 gels on the high end? So that's kind of max of the max would theoretically make sense. Once you start to go above, you know, 100 grams per hour, the studies generally show that you don't further oxidize that carbohydrate and it basically just stays in the gut.
Which is bad.
You don't want generally carbohydrates staying in the gut because it causes those gastrointestinal problems. The question is, you know, how often do you have to do this? For how long? I think it's, you know, scientifically it's not clear. I would say at least a few times prior to your race, you're going to want to practice that rate for probably at least a couple hours. Ideally in the environment that you're going to exercise in terms of maybe the humidity, the pace, and try and mimic those same things as best as you can that you're going to experience during the race, if you can.
I always have kind of viewed this as kind of a no-duh solution. Like, you know, let's just say an athlete decides, I need to take in 250 calories an hour during the race. They've gone through their planning. That's how much they need for whatever rationale. They need to either train at that level or greater in order to be able to tolerate that stress during the race.
Absolutely.
And I once again, I make the physical analogy, like if I had an athlete that I knew needed to average 10-minute pace for 50 miles, I would sure as heck make sure that they could handle 10-minute pace for whatever their training distance actually looked like. I wouldn't ask them to run 8-minute pace during the race because it's something their body clearly can't handle.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you just think you're going to go out for 60 minutes and practice it once or twice before a 100-mile race and feel like, oh, I practiced this, it's going to be good to go.
Right.
Especially when you look at nausea tends to be worse in the latter half of an ultra. And, you know, people can get confused and other things can happen that can make it difficult to stick to your plan. So if you haven't practiced that, I mean, that's obviously going to be a recipe for some athletes to have really bad experiences in terms of their feeding regimen. So yeah, I would agree with that. You want to, at a minimum, practice it at the intensity that you're going to be working at. It's hard to probably mimic a full 100-mile race in training. So, that's probably unrealistic to think that you're going to do exactly that during training is what you do in a race. But at least go periods of maybe multiple hours at that rate that you're eating to see how you're going to handle it.
Yeah, but still, even at that, this is kind of a logical guess from the extension of the research. The research demonstrates that it's plausible that we can get some sort of adaptation if we stress the GI system in some way. In this way, it's overfeeding, essentially. It's reasonable to say, okay, if we did that and did it in a repeated fashion for weeks or maybe months leading up to the event, that some sort of positive adaptation would occur.
Yeah, I mean, I think the research is good enough to say that if you take someone who's not accustomed to eating 90 grams of carbohydrate an hour, have them do that, and then have them train for a couple of weeks and do that, their symptoms will go down pretty dramatically. So they do tolerate that more aggressive approach much better than when they first started. And that's what the Costa study showed, was that GI symptoms were really actually bad the first baseline test they did.
Right.
It was like 50% of people who had severe symptoms on this 90 gram per hour rate. And then over the course of the study, by the end, those symptoms went down pretty significantly. So yeah, if you're going to try the very aggressive carbohydrate intake approach, which isn't necessarily whatever athlete needs to do, but if you're going to try it, then yeah, it makes logical sense that you're going to practice that in training and do it multiple times before your race.
We've thrown out this like 60 to 90 gram of carbohydrate per hour recommendation a few times. I want to back up a little bit for the listeners because this is a common recommendation that sports scientists and nutrition scientists throw out for events that last beyond 2 to 4 hours. And there's this really interesting divergence in the ultramarathon world where I know as a practitioner that's a common recommendation, and I would make the guess that many athletes have heard that recommendation as well. Yet, and all of the research teases this out, which you're very well aware of, that is practiced by very few athletes in an ultramarathon setting. And it's not even close. When they take surveys of ultra runners after races, they're in the 30 to 40 grams per hour Which would be on the order of like 1.5 gels or something like that. So just to calibrate everybody, 60 to 90 grams per hour would be 2.5 to 3 gels would be 75 grams mm-hmm. per hour. So almost 3.5 gels per hour for the entirety of an ultra. There are very, very, very few people that actually can pull that off during a race. And it leads me to one of two conclusions. Either the athletes are getting it wrong or the research recommendations are wrong in some way, because the practice is very divergent from the recommendations. I want to know what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah. I mean, that's an excellent question. I mean, I've seen in the research too that, and it's not only for ultra marathons, but for other athletic endeavors. If you look at even team-based sports or regular marathons, the amount of carbohydrate that people consume is oftentimes lower than what the recommendations are. I guess a couple of points is one that a lot of these recommendations were based on higher level athletes. And as endurance sports have gotten more popular, you have more people participating who honestly probably don't need to consume 90 grams of carbohydrate per hour. Now,
that's
in the ultra
what I look
world,
at it as.
It's maybe a little bit different because you self-select to people who are going to be better, who are going to be probably more not your weekend warrior type athlete. So I think it's maybe a little bit more surprising that the intakes are sometimes lower with ultra runners. But yeah, I mean, not every athlete needs to consume 80 grams of an hour of carbohydrate. I mean, that even ultra runners, if you're mostly concerned with finishing and you're not simply worried about your best time ever, then I don't know that it's as critical to have to consume that high level of carbohydrate. The reason why you see those high recommendations to some extent is to see maximally how much carbohydrate can we oxidize, because it's a more efficient fuel than fat. So if you're looking at especially like a world record setting marathoner, Kipchoge, to be able to run a 2-hour marathon, you basically have to completely rely on carbohydrate to do that.
Right.
And you don't have enough glycogen stores to do that. So if you want to maintain carbohydrate burning through that entire race, you really have to consume a pretty large amount of carbohydrate. And he does. I mean, he consumes 90 grams an hour of carbohydrate from the reports that I've seen. So for an event like the regular marathon where the intensity is higher and the natural rate of carbohydrate burning is higher, and you're an elite athlete, it makes a lot of sense to me to go high. For a middle-of-the-road ultra runner, I don't know. I mean, it's up to them. It kind of depends on their experience. I don't think it's necessarily an absolute that they have to consume that much.
Yeah, I've just always, when that research gets translated down mm-hmm. to the everyday ultra runner, I just think that it gets misconstrued just from simple math, because their caloric burn rate, if you just take, you know, average mid-pack 100-mile finisher, their caloric burn rate is going to be maybe 700 calories an hour, maybe.
At the most, yeah.
Yeah, at the very most. And they're probably at a 50-50 split, carbohydrate versus fat that they're burning. So that means they only need to replace, if they want to keep everything even, 350 calories an hour, and then they've got a tank to deal with. So I kind of like look at the math and I'm like, wait a minute, hold on, 90 grams, like they're going to be in a surplus if they're 90 grams for a lot. I mean, just based on that math.
No, I agree. Yeah. If you look at energy expenditures, it's hard for ultra races because, you know, you could have like a portable metabolic unit, which I think a couple of case studies have done. You might see the energy expenditures on the winners. You know, if it's maybe a 50 to 100 mile, I want to say that's where you start to dip below 1,000 calories an hour. It gets into the 700 to 900 for a good runner. And then the middle of the road is probably 500 or 600, depending on who it is. Yeah, you know, logically, it doesn't make sense to me that they would have to consume 70, 80, 90 grams an hour. And the risk of GI distress does go up with that. Even if you train your gut, there's probably some extra risk with that. So middle of the pack ultra runner who's not super concerned about setting records or the PRs, and they're not going that fast to begin with, you know, practice what you think you're going to use and make individual adjustments based on your experience would be my recommendation.
This is my last tangent on the 60 to 90 grams per hour question. I mean, because once again, I've seen it time and time again. I've written about it a lot, and I sometimes just kind of shake my head because of the specificity of that recommendation towards elite athletes. And I still think that we don't quite know some things as the distance gets longer. But what's your opinion on how time dependent that is? Meaning, can you actually, we know that the body can tolerate that rate, 90 grams per hour, if you have the right carbohydrate mix, but I don't know. And I don't think that it is actually known how long in theory or in practice that could actually be tolerated for, because the studies on those are, from an ultra perspective, actually pretty short, 4 hours.
Yeah, I think the longest is like 4 or 5 hours. Yeah. You know, I don't know. I mean, the other thing was, as you go farther out in distance, the natural intensity of those events gets lower. Right. So the reliance on carbohydrate is probably less to begin with. So my thought is the 60 to 90 grams per hour is probably most relevant for athletes who are doing things at an elite level from maybe 2 hours to 4 hours. Once you start getting into the ultra stuff, does it or does it not help to go higher? We really don't know, to be honest. Yeah. If you're really pushing the boundaries, if you are trying to set records, then there is maybe some theoretical justification for going high. But for most ultra runners, I don't know that it really is that solid in terms of translating what the research says to what practically makes sense for an average athlete.
Yeah. I like that. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Okay. That's enough down that rabbit hole. So we're talking about the ways that ultra runners kind of cope with nausea and these two kind of divergent strategies. One of them is training the gut. And just to summarize that, you're essentially having to take in the calorie count that you would have taken in during the race for in training sessions for a few to several weeks before the race in order to get any sort of adaptation. That's an extension of the research that's out there. It's not known, but Right. It's a reasonable extension of Yeah. That research. There's this other strategy it's almost in a polar opposite direction, because one of them is I'm going to train things to tolerate more. And the other strategy is I'm going to train things so that I don't need as much of it. And that is training your body to utilize more fat. Now, I want to kind of stick with our theme here of the athlete's gut.
Yeah.
So when an athlete takes on any of the fat adaptation strategies, whether it's a day-to-day nutritional intervention or a fasted run or back-to-back runs, why don't you walk the listeners through what are the changes that happen to the GI system whenever an athlete undertakes those?
So yeah, you've got basically macronutrient specific adaptations that happens in the gut. And some of those happen at the stomach. Some of those happen in the small intestine. Probably a little bit less known about what happens in the large intestine. But with the stomach, generally, it tends to be nutrient specific. So if you eat a lot of fat in your diet over the course of a few days to a couple of weeks, the emptying of that fat tends to be accelerated compared to a baseline. If you eat a high carbohydrate diet, the emptying of that carbohydrate, if you give someone a test meal that's high in carbohydrate after a few days to a couple of weeks, the emptying of that accelerates. So your gut seems to respond to what you put in it. And what's probably happening is the tissue in your small intestine right outside of the stomach maybe gets desensitized to that nutrient over time. Because usually what happens is if you eat a lot of fat or you eat a huge amount of glucose in one sitting, once that gets into the small intestine, it activates tissue that talks back to the stomach and says, slow down, we are putting too much into the small intestine right now. We can't handle that level of nutrient. But it seems like over time that the stomach adapts to empty faster when you habitually eat something in the diet in high amounts. So,
Can I pause you right there? Yeah. Does it also maladapt?
That's a good question. So,
and what I mean, just to clarify this for the listeners, when you're taking a high carbohydrate diet, does it maladapt to the other macros, protein and or fat? Or if you take a high fat approach, does it maladapt to the carbohydrate and or protein in that fashion as well?
Yeah, I'm not as entirely sure on that. My guess is that I don't think it's going to maladapt. The one exception would be is if you shifted from eating something that's, for example, really high carb to extremely low carb and bump up the fat extremely. So I think it's proportional to probably the amount of change in the diet in terms of the how aggressive that change is. I mean, most of the studies that are looking at more rapid emptying of the stomach for more carbohydrate, for example, are using a pretty hefty dose. I mean, it's maybe a couple hundred extra grams of glucose per day supplemented on top of what these people are already eating. So to me, these adaptations would seem to occur more readily when you're making big shifts. So that would apply to an athlete who's going keto or super low carb in an attempt to, for example, they're trying to deal with some of their gut issues. then during a race, if they decide that they're going to rely on carbohydrates for whatever reason, they may have some more issues in comparison to an athlete that habitually consumes a high carb diet. That's all theoretical. There aren't specifically studies in an exercise setting showing athletes that are fat adapted, if you give them lots of carb, they have more GI symptoms. Those studies, as far as I'm aware, don't exist.
Yeah, I mean, the exception that I'll bring to the table there is out of the Supernova group, Louise Burke's group out of the Australian Institute for Sport, where they took the race walkers through a ketogenic and a high fat protocol, and they all, and this is a research that, or this is a piece of research that you cited in your book as well. And the high fat group underperformed compared to the periodized carb group in the race walking test. And the biochemical rationale for that was they weren't able to uptake as much, or they weren't able to utilize glycogen at the same rate as the periodized group.
Yeah. Trent Stellingworth, who did his PhD maybe 10, 15 years ago, did a really intricate study, neat study, where they try to look at the mechanism of that.
Right.
And you see that when you go on a high fat, low carb diet, even if you restore glycogen levels, so if you put somebody on a high fat diet for a couple of weeks, but then a day or two before the exercise, even if you give them more carb, they still are not able to turn the jets on. And the mechanism, or one of them, is a reduction in pyruvate dehydrogenase, which is an enzyme that's involved in metabolizing carbohydrate. So these athletes, if they want to kick it into an extra gear, especially for prolonged periods, they just, the biochemistry, it doesn't seem to allow them to do that. More relevant for certain sports where that's more important, right? Where you are kicking it into a higher gear. If it's a race that lasts 24 hours, it may or may not matter. But for certain sports, anywhere from a half marathon to a full marathon, eating a high fat diet probably isn't going to be real good in terms of your performance if you're at an elite level.
Training, right? Yeah. I mean, because a lot of ultra marathon training can be, depending upon the athlete. A lot of athletes just go and run. But some ultra marathon athletes, they do intervals and things like that are not dissimilar from, you know, high caliber marathoners would actually do. And I would say that there's training implication there as well. So can you have the best of both worlds? That's like the $64,000 question, right?
I know the high fat debate, high carb debate for ultra running is a big issue right now. It's just really hard because those studies are almost impossible to do at the distances that those events are done at. What I would say, theoretically, it starts to make some plausibility when you get past, you know, maybe 50 miles to 100 miles in that range, where if you look at the energy expenditure of those events and you look at the FASTER study from Jeff Olick, and you see if you take the energy expenditure from fat oxidation in those studies, they start to line up with what you could potentially achieve in maybe a 50 plus mile race. Now, that is just solely looking at the bioenergetics and not considering how do you feel when you don't ingest carbohydrate or very small amounts of carbohydrate for 100 miles. So in theory, I think maybe there's some sense, or for some athletes, there's maybe some benefits. You go from maybe 50 mile plus, I think there is some speculation that it could be helpful. Now, with the GI symptoms, I mean, I don't know. That's another one that's hard to figure out scientifically, whether or not there's more or less GI symptoms for an athlete that's switched to a high-fat approach. But from the bioenergetics and performance, you know, that's kind of the threshold I think about, is maybe a 50-mile race plus, where theoretically there could be some.
Where it's plausible.
Plausible.
Right? Where the energetics are plausible enough that you can liberate fat at the rate that you need it while you're exercising.
I think in that study, the highest fat oxidizer, this was during their VO2 max test, not during the submaximal, was 1.75 grams per minute. And if that extrapolates out to maybe 900 or so calories, maybe a little bit more. Yeah. I mean, in a full regular marathon, I mean, you're working at a higher rate than that. So those athletes, it doesn't make sense bioenergetically to go low carb.
And just to give the listeners a little bit of a relevant point there. So 1.75 grams of fat oxidized per minute is fairly high. What would you see? You had a college kid. We went through your lab earlier today. You brought a college kid that, you know, is playing basketball, right over here to our right-hand side, and you put them and had them do an incremental exercise test. What's their fat max going to be?
If you put them, so it depends on their diet, but I'd have to go back and look at the specific numbers. It's usually less than one.
Yeah. That's what I wanted to get at, is that in the what that Volokh study has become more renowned for is not the fact that the low carb and the ketogenic group burned more fat. That's kind of a no shit statement, right? Yes. It's the rate, right? That rate that they were
the absolute
rate that they were actually able to get up to where they're like, oh wow, that actually is. But I can tell you from our lab, and we have a lot of high caliber athletes mm-hmm. that come through our lab. We're in Colorado Springs. And so some of the Olympic athletes will come there from time to time, as well as our own elite athletes. It's like, it's not that far off, and we don't manipulate their diet beforehand.
Yeah.
It's really like, I kind of look at it from a sports science perspective. And this is another tangent. I kind of look at those rates of fat oxidation from a sports science perspective and go, well, you know, we got elite athletes that are kind of in the ballpark of that.
Yeah. And it's the other thing is these bioenergetic changes don't necessarily translate to differences in performance.
That's correct.
You don't always want to assume that if you burn more fat or even if you burn more carb, that always going to lead to better performance. I think on the whole, if you switch people to a high fat diet, they do burn more fat at a moderate exercise intensity. The question becomes, are there impairments to that when they try and do things that are higher intensity? And then are there other issues that really we don't understand about its effects on the central nervous system or other things beyond just how much ATP are you producing?
So we've gone through these two different strategies as well as kind of an overlay of what causes nausea. I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit.
Yeah.
Let's say I'm an athlete that comes to you, you're the expert, and I'm saying, you know what? Every time I go into a 50-mile or 100-mile race at point X, 75% through the race or whatever, I start to experience nausea to the extent that it affects my performance. What steps would you take me through? And then what would be the outcomes of those steps in order to get some relief from it?
I mean, I would probably start with the things that are more easily modifiable. So looking at your rate of fluid ingestion, looking at your rate of carbohydrate ingestion to see if you're either under or potentially over consuming either of those. Because both, as we've talked about, can be contributors. Now, how do you figure out if you're under or over consuming? You might do a field test where you compare, you know, this athlete naturally decides that they're going to drink at 500 milliliters per hour, regardless of the weather conditions. Let's say that leads to a 7% loss in body mass. You could field test to see if you put them at a higher rate of fluid ingestion, does that have any impact on nausea? So that's one step, practically speaking, you could take to take a look at. Is that one of the contributing factors in that environment?
To do a sweat test and see if something higher than the sweat test triggers it. I mean, sweat test is something that's, I've written about it a few times, common field test that a lot of athletes do. You go, you run an hour, you see how much weight you lose. That's how much you're sweating out. You're saying, go and do another trial where you're consuming fluid over that loss.
Correct. I mean, most runners seem to be pretty good about self-regulating based on thirst and things like that. However, I have an issue sometimes when people will say that thirst is the option that works best for everybody in every environment, because you see in some studies there's a percent of people, a minority, who really, if you look at their either weight loss or their changes in plasma volume, they're pretty significant. It would seem like they're under consuming fluid. So even if the average in some of these studies seems to be fine, you see, for example, huge variations in plasma volume changes at the end of an ultra race. The difference may be on average nothing, but the variation is sometimes huge. So that would indicate to me that there are some athletes, yes, who could benefit from a sweat testing protocol, see where they're at, maybe try replacing a little bit higher percentage of their losses. I wouldn't recommend trying to place all of it in most cases,
right.
But maybe a higher percentage.
But you're trying to figure out if that's a trigger,
yeah.
Right? If the amount of fluid is a trigger.
Yeah, and kind of taking a step-by-step approach, starting with one thing and trying to isolate it, because when you get into an environment where you're manipulating multiple things at once, it becomes really problematic sometimes to figure out which of these is really the culprit. So to me, fluid, carbohydrate intake, other food intake, sodium intake, looking at what the athlete is doing to see if those are easy fixes to start off with.
Okay. And then let's just say that it's food intake. I'm just taking in too much food over the course of time. This gets back to the, do I train myself to consume more, or do I train myself to be able to rely on endogenous fat more? How would you go about getting that answer?
I don't really know, to be honest. I don't know if there's an answer to that.
Because I get this, man. I'm trying to like, this is a little bit from my
I'm trying to think through, you know, maybe if the person is already, if they've already had experience saying that they've practiced this, they've tried it, and it just doesn't seem to work for them, for whatever reason, they've got a sensitive gut, no matter how much they practice, then yeah, I would probably go the approach of, okay, let's maybe see if we can switch your diet overall so that you have to rely less on exogenous fuel. I mean, it's probably going to be a trial and error approach. And I don't think there's really any easy answers.
That's what everybody hates is the trial and error approach to it. You know, they want like simple answers. Like just tell me the, you know, red pill or blue pill, like tell me which one to take.
If it was simple, 60% of ultra runners wouldn't have nausea. I mean, it's true. You know,
good point.
So it's multifactorial. So in most cases, doing one thing oftentimes will not completely alleviate the problem. It may make it better, but it probably in a lot of cases is not enough on its own to completely resolve it.
But you would, let me kind of cast an overview of the recommendations that you would make for a runner that continually has nausea in an ultra marathon. You would first start to isolate the big variables, food, fluid, volume, and then figure out which one of those is the trigger through trial and error. Mm-hmm. And then once you figure out which one of the, or more of the trigger, I guess, right? Which one of those is more of the trigger. And then based off of that, you're going to adjust within that one specific thing to get more to the ideal.
Yeah. I mean, you would have maybe some sort of field setting where you test the athlete before and after your sort of little case study intervention to see how much of a benefit you get. And trying to maybe just change one thing at a time. So as opposed to, okay, now I'm going to consume more fluid. Now I'm going to consume more carb. At the same time, it, you know, it can be a little bit more problematic to figure out which of those issues is really more of a factor for you. I mean, I would start with kind of the easily modifiable things or more easily modifiable things. And then from there, if those don't solve the problem, then you maybe have to start looking at other potential things, whether it be a gastrointestinal condition, whether it be, you know, looking at someone's osmolality before and after a run, looking at the increase in things like urea or creatine kinase for how much muscle damage they have. I mean, it gets really
advanced interventions at that point.
And at that point, you're kind of grasping at straws trying to figure out what the heck is going on. Or you could try the intervention approach like medication or supplements to hope that even if you have an underlying issue, maybe that would help dampen the severity of the nausea.
Let's move on to the medication and supplements piece, because I know there are a lot of athletes that are looking at that from as simple as, hey, I'm going to take a course of Prilosec, you know, 7 days before a race, to I'm going to have this elaborate supplementation program with all these probiotics and they're going to get shipped to me every month. And that area is like really hot right now. I'm going to drink kombucha every day and all this stuff. Can you kind of like summarize those, the supplement and the medication interventions, and then we can kind of drill down into a couple of those and why they may or may not work.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the medication for ultras, you know, you look at sort of anti-emetics or anti-nausea medications. Zofran or ondansetron, I think, is the one that is probably the most often kept on hand at ultra races. So as far as I'm aware, there are not actually like randomized double-blind studies in that environment that show that medication works. However, anecdotally, it seems like athletes get relief from it, whether it's a placebo effect or something else.
It's a commonly prescribed anti-nausea medicine. Mm-hmm. It's not like they're just pulling out, they're just grasping at a random straw.
And that's going to be, you know, a little bit more challenging sometimes to access that, obviously. I mean, it's generally something that a race director might be giving you or prescribing. It's not going to be something you buy off the shelf and take on your own. Supplement-wise, you know, it's probiotics would be the one that, as you mentioned, is really popular that oftentimes athletes will turn to. Ginger is one that in other situations has been fairly effective at alleviating nausea. Now, in exercise, there's not really any data with that, but pregnancy, morning sickness, chemotherapy, motion sickness, spinning people in a chair seems to work decently for at least moderately reducing nausea. I think maybe the difficulty of using that during an ultra is it can also provoke heartburn, stomach irritation if you take it in large dosages. So if you're going to use that, what I would say is probably take it an hour or two before the race, because the effects seem to maybe last a while. So maybe that would be something that delays the development of nausea as you progress into the race. I mean, that's all based on just speculation.
I had an athlete that would use raw ginger during a race.
How much?
Like a little, just like a look. You guys can't, this is a failure of audio. I'm showing Patrick how big it was. It was maybe like 1 centimeter squared.
Okay.
Which is, I mean, that's not a trivial amount of raw ginger
right.
to just eat
yeah.
on the side of a trail,
right.
but he's sore by it.
Yeah. I mean, it's, if you're having problems figuring out where your nausea is coming from and it's, you know, medical things have been ruled out. I mean, it's a relatively safe thing you can try that may have some benefit for some people. Implementation wise, I think the issue would be not taking too much at once during the race because it, you know, can lead to other GI issues. So maybe taking something an hour or two before the race starts, and then theoretically maybe taking something a little bit later on, so long as it's not a huge dose. And most studies are using like a gram or two
right.
one sitting.
How much validity is there to improving your gut flora? I know this is going to be a loaded question for you.
The microbiota.
Man, yeah. It's hot right now. How much validity is there to improving that to reduce nausea during an ultra marathon race through whatever mechanism, whether it's diet or supplementation or whatever?
Nausea specifically, very little to none. So the studies in athletes who have that have used probiotics have been mixed. Some have shown modest benefit. Some have been neutral. At least one has shown greater incidence of mild GI upset. So it's kind of across the board. But really none of them, as far as I'm aware, have really isolated nausea specifically. And most of the exercise durations they were working with were fairly short. So it's probably fairly low risk to try, but I don't know how much benefit there really is specifically with the type of nausea that arises at the end of a ultra race. I mean, if it's not, you know, necessarily something that you have a good idea about what's causing it, you know, it's kind of throwing stuff against the wall and hoping that it'll do something for you, which maybe it will, but the evidence doesn't necessarily support that it's going to be the most efficacious thing.
But you're not only throwing it against the wall from that, it's also strain specific, right? The efficacy of any of the probiotics is extremely specific to the strain of that's actually in the supplement that you're taking. And almost everybody have no idea what that strain specificity is because the words on the back of the label have like, you know, 30 different letters in them. And they're like, wait, what is this again? What am I looking
for? Yeah, that's an excellent point. I mean, the thing with probiotics, and this applies to not only athletes, but irritable bowel syndrome, right. other gut disorders where, you know, the evidence is very mixed, probably in large part because the species and strains of bacteria that have been used vary a lot from study to study. The dosages vary a lot from study to study. So in terms of practical implementation, it makes it pretty challenging to give any sort of individual prescription about what you should do as an athlete. I would say that most of the studies that are using probiotics that show some sort of benefit, whether it be athlete or non-athlete, use lactobacillus and bifidobacteria species. So if you buy a supplement that has a variety of those types of bacteria in them, that's probably a safe bet. But again, it's not a for sure thing, and it's kind of throwing something against the wall, hoping that maybe it'll do something for you.
But here's my thing with that. You just mentioned a very specific strain, right?
Yeah.
Nobody's going to be able to remember that. After just hearing this podcast, with all due respect to you, they're gonna what did that mean? And they're gonna go try to find it, and they're gonna have to listen to this podcast again. And it's so complicated for a layperson to actually unwind and understand.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. The bifidobacteria and the lactobacilli, those are kind of the genuses, the broader categories of bacteria that you have strains and species within that. So the long name where there's three things a part of it, the first part of it, the lactobacilli or the bifidobacteria, those are kind of broad classifications that a lot of probiotics contain. But you're right. I mean, beyond that, when you get deeply into the different species and the strains, you know, it gets pretty convoluted. And as a regular everyday athlete, I mean, it's really hard to come up with a regimen that's science-based. I mean, honestly, it just is.
Yeah, it's just a big area right now. A lot of people making money off
it. It's very hot right now, as you know, know if that's a Zoolander quote there. I don't know if you drop a lot of Zoolander quotes.
No, we can't. We'll drop some Zoolander quotes on this.
Okay, maybe a few years past. It's
yeah. You know, I remember it very fondly. But needless to say, I mean, you wouldn't like if you going back to my analogy earlier. You had an athlete coming into you. Hey, I'm always having nausea. You would still take. What are you taking during the event? What are you taking day to day approach first?
Yeah.
Before moving on to any of the medical or, you know, supplemental types of interventions.
Yeah. I mean, unless someone has other symptoms where it seems clear that maybe they have a gastrointestinal medical condition going on, if it's just isolated nausea and a few other things that seem to appear the latter half of an ultra race, yeah, start with the nutrition stuff, you know, carbohydrate, fluid, sodium potentially, other supplements or things you're consuming that could be provoking the gut. Start with that and then move on to the things that become a little bit more complicated. I mean, you want to rule out the easier stuff first before you start to get real fancy with what you're trying to figure out.
Well, and speaking of fancy, I don't know where you put this in the list. How does psychology play into all of this? Because this is a big part of your book as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's a third, by volume, it's, you know, there's three parts of the book. It's basically the intro, nutrition's the biggest, the middle section, and then there's a third part on psychology.
I love how you have to talk about it by volume. Yeah. Just like we talk about, you know, fluid.
Parts.
And yeah, exactly.
I should say parts. It's not a three-volume set. It's 300 pages, so it's not going to come in a, you know, 10-pound box.
I just like the fact that, you know, by volume, by word count, I do the same thing. This is okay. Okay. Yeah. So we're talking about psychology right in the gut. How much does that play an impact?
I mean, I think it definitely plays a pretty large role for a subset of athletes. So this is surprisingly from the research side, something that is not well studied. I mean, every athlete has an experience, an anecdote where they were nervous before a race, before a game, or even outside of athletics. You're nervous before an interview, before a presentation, and you know, your gut does not seem to be functioning well. So it's not like it's groundbreaking research to show that people who have more anxiety with competition have more gastrointestinal problems. But surprisingly, there are really few studies that have done that. I mean, I've done a couple in the last few years that seem to confirm that people who have more stress and anxiety do seem to be more predisposed to gastrointestinal problems during training and also during competition. So I think it does play a role in a subset of athletes who struggle with anxiety, who struggle with managing stress. So it's not a primary culprit in every athlete by any means, but it certainly is something to take a look at, especially if you have one of those athletes that seems to have trouble managing their race day nerves. You know, they just can't get on top of it. So yeah, that's definitely one to look at.
Do you want to hear one of my theories on that?
Yeah.
Why it starts to rear its ugly head during especially in an ultra, is for almost everybody, there's like one mile marker or one section of the race that contains an inordinate amount of unknown, because you don't go and run 100 mile or 50 miles in training in order to do those races. And so they're always extending whatever their normal training run would be. Especially for athletes that are inexperienced at the distance, they have that psychological block of, oh my God, I've only run 30 miles or whatever it is, and now I'm doing this 100 mile race. When they get to mile 35, even though it's really no big deal, they're so pent up about what's going to happen. I haven't done this in training. I've never experienced this before. That just adds one more toxic element to this soup that eventually unfolds into nausea.
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense to me in that you see studies that look at what are the predictors of GI symptoms during endurance races, during competition, and repeatedly experience is one of those things that does correlate with a lower rate. So if you're more experienced, the more times you've done something, it's not a super strong correlation, but it is measurable. It is sizable enough to say that it seems like if you practice something over time or you've done something over time, it makes sense that you're going to be probably less stressed about it, less anxious about it. So that makes sense to me in terms of that would be a contributing factor in an athlete who's super new to the sport or to that race. They don't know what to expect. As you said, it's impossible to completely go through that race without doing it the whole time or doing it the first time yourself. So there's going to be more unknowns. You know, I think if you couple that with an athlete who gets a lot of pre-competition anxiety, you know, that's the recipe of where it's much more likely to have problems.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, I've seen it time and time again, like going to races. And when I say see it, I mean that literally, like you can see the anxiety like unfold on their face. And when you see them at an aid station, it's literally a look and a vibe that you get. And it almost always is coupled with at that immediate point in time, or maybe at the next aid station, 5 miles down the road or whatever. Sure enough, they'll come in. Oh, my stomach's in knots. This doesn't sound good. That doesn't sound good. I puked, back there, whatever it is. It's so predictable.
Yeah. So, I think that it's something to take a look at for sure. You know, the studies that I've done on it, there was one where we took 150 runners for a month. They basically tracked every one of the runs. They reported after each run what their gastrointestinal symptoms were during that run. And at the end of the month, they rated their anxiety and stress on validated questionnaires. And we just simply kind of looked at, what's the association there? Are people who are reporting more anxiety, more stress, more predisposed to having issues? And of anything in the study, it was one that was correlated with more symptoms. Maybe a little bit more particularly upper GI symptoms, but there were still correlations with the lower GI symptoms. Now, the associations are not super strong. But none of these studies where you look at correlations, are they ever strong?
Right.
Because there's multiple factors that play a role, and you should never expect one single factor to completely explain why people are experiencing problems.
Well, and that's one of the fascinating things about your area of research is it's always multifactorial. I mean, very, very, very rarely can you look at a case study or a scenario and go, oh, that's it right there.
Yeah.
Like just, as long as you switch this from this to that, like you're going to be, free and clear. It's a lot of, educated guessing and deductive logic and things like that to try to like pinpoint actually what's going on.
Yeah. I mean, in your own experience, when you have athletes who have had these problems, what kind of approach have you taken to try and figure out what's going on? What's as a practitioner, the way that you deal with it? Because from my side, I'm more of a researcher. I'm more study the problem, try and figure it out, give some practical recommendations, but I'm not a, endurance coach.
It's the exact same thing. Okay. We look at the inventory in terms of what's going on, and then I compare that to what have they done. So if one of my athletes already know that, right? Because we've gone through the whole thing in training. What did you do? What types of things are you taking in during your long runs and things like that? And then we try to match it up during the race or the training activity that caused the distress and try to figure out where the mismatches are. Okay, it's too much fluid, not enough fluid, too much sodium, not enough sodium. And a lot of times you'll find those mismatches, and that's just kind of coaching. But even when we go through that and you try to massage the situation to get as good as we can, and this is why this is one of those areas that's just so fascinating. Still on race day, because the race is usually so much harder and so much longer and so much more stressful than anything that you could ever recreate in training, you can still have those issues crop up. And to your point, it is an experience thing. So then you take the inventory of the race experience, which is harder, longer, more stressful than what they've done in training. You compare it to what they were doing in training, what they should have done during the race, and you try to find those mismatches and then correct them. And I've always taken train the gut approach first and then do a dietary intervention second. And that is, there's a whole host of reasons why I do that. Mainly it's just training related, because I think that impacts training less, because you're still training an athlete at the end of the day. And whenever you take an overall nutrition intervention, you have to manage it with the training load and the training stress appropriately. So that's what I do is I take a training the gut approach for or inventory, training the gut, and then if needed, the dietary intervention goes last. The dietary intervention being that we're going to burn more. We're going to teach you how to burn more fat.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
So let's wrap it up a little bit. Let's go over just some key, incredibly practical recommendations for athletes, for ultra marathon athletes that have GI distress, which that's everybody that's listening, by the way. It's not 6 out of 10 or 7 out of 10. I guarantee
at some point it's 100%.
Yeah. That point is well taken. At some point during the entirety of their ultra marathon career, it will be them.
Yeah.
So it's everybody listening, all five people, but everybody listening is going to experience every ultra runner out there is going to experience GI distress in some form or fashion at some point during their ultramarathon career. And if they don't, they're a freaking unicorn and come talk to me afterwards. But what are the maybe top three or five like super practical things that, that any ultra runner can kind of walk away with and either work on or learn about to not have a magic bullet to fix it, but just to reduce the likelihood and the severity of the symptoms?
Yeah. I mean, I would probably say that the biggest thing for a lot of athletes, as we've already hit on this, is going to be practice what you're doing in the environment as best you can to match the demands of the race, with the realization that you're not ever going to be able to completely, in most cases, match those demands. In terms of nutrition, I would say take a close look at whether you're underhydrating or overhydrating, because they both can contribute to nausea.
It's relative to the conditions.
Relative to the conditions. In hot environments, the underhydration is probably more plausible. The other thing I would say is, if it is a hot environment, humid environment, we haven't talked about this, but maybe using some cooling strategies. I mean, that seems like an obvious thing for performance, but it probably plays a role in GI symptoms too. Consistently, you see when you put athletes at the same exercise intensity in a hot lab versus a temperate lab, GI symptoms go up. So acclimatize to your environment, practice cooling strategies, employ cooling strategies if it's a hot day, make sure your hydration's on point as best you can.
You need to go out to Badwater and just watch that race unfold.
Yeah.
You would find it. Have you ever been out there before?
No, no.
You'd find it fascinating because everybody has a slightly different strategy. They're all trying to cool off, mm-hmm. but everybody has a slightly different nutrition strategy, which ranges from all liquid, like literally all liquid, which you're familiar with. That's a strategy that a lot of ultra endurance athletes do, not just ultra runners, but ultra endurance athletes do, to real food and water and everything else in between.
Yeah.
And very few of them actually get it right. It's because it's so hard. The race is so hard. That's what makes it such a cool pun intended, such a cool playground, because the race is so hard because of the heat.
Yeah. It's, you know, I come from sort of a mix of endurance background, team sport background. So I was more of a basketball, tennis, distance running until my knee and hip decided it wasn't real good to continue on with long distances. So, I mean, I've got a mixture of stuff, but the ultra stuff has never been what I've been able to handle.
But for you, I guarantee
for you as a researcher,
just go out there and watch people. First, you'll be like, what are these idiots doing? Like, it's like the most bizarre ultramarathon ever. But in terms of having a playground that stresses athletes out mm-hmm. to their maximum, and especially in your area of expertise, it's absolutely fascinating.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've done some field-based studies with like a half Ironman triathlon, but that's a whole different environment in terms
way different.
Yeah.
Way very different. Triathletes. They don't hold the candle to us. Okay. So keep going. So test it out, especially at hot mm-hmm. and
cooling strategies. Yep. Potentially. I would look at, you know, if you are the type of person that struggles with competition, anxiety, stress, considering not only maybe just pre-competition, but from day to day, trying some interventions that, you know, we see in other populations help reduce the severity of GI issues. That could be deep breathing, meditation, mindfulness. They seem to work pretty well at making people less sensitive in terms of how their gut feels to certain stimuli. So whether that's doing it right before the race, like if you're going to do deep breathing a half hour beforehand, or just do it on a day-to-day basis, if you're kind of a wired athlete who's high strung, who struggles with that stuff, I think it is of anything is one of the more low risk, potentially high benefit things you could try. You know, beyond that, it gets a little complicated, but one other simple thing you can do is avoid taking lots of NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. I know a lot of runners have minor aches and pains and things that they use those medications for. But at least in high dosages during ultra, you know, they're likely to contribute to GI issues.
If I have an athlete that has that in a drop bag, I throw it away.
Good.
Seriously. because sometimes they won't tell me.
Yeah.
Like, that's probably bad coaching on my part. But if I find it and somebody's crew has mm-hmm. it, or they packed it in a drop bag, I just throw it away.
I mean, to some extent, if you can't make it through a race without taking a high dose NSAID, maybe you shouldn't just do the race. Or find other ways to help manage that pain. Because they're really, I mean, not only on the GI system, but they're problematic for athletes for a lot of different reasons. May increase the risk of hypernatremia.
You could die.
You could die. You could have severe gastrointestinal bleeding in some cases.
You could die. That's all you should be able to say.
And they increase the risk of cardiovascular events in the population.
You
could
die. So. Did you see Ironman sign a partnership with Aleve?
No.
Oh my gosh. I wrote an op-ed in Triathlete Magazine, which I very rarely do because it's not the sport group that I typically work with. But I lost it, and they contacted me, and they were like, "Will you write an op-ed for this?" I'm like, "Absolutely, I'll write an op-ed for it." Like, and the summary was, "Is this is a terrible partnership because somebody's going to die."
I mean, taking a ibuprofen here and there is not a big deal, but if you're using it like chronically in high dose, especially, it's problematic.
During a race?
Yeah.
That's okay. So don't take NSAIDs.
Yeah. So in terms of the gastrointestinal system, that's a bad choice is to take high dose NSAIDs before or during. You know, beyond that, I mean, it gets into some more nuanced things that probably don't have, you know, infinite amount of time to go through the list of.
That's why you wrote the book.
That's why I wrote the books. Check out the book.
You can plug the book. It's cool. By the way, in an effort of full disclosure, we have the same publisher, Velo Press, which is now Pocket Outdoor Media. I always have a hard time remembering that they changed their name. And that's how Patrick and I got introduced, but it's his book. It's a great book. I read an advanced copy of it. I think it's a fantastic resource for athletes. So why don't you tell them a little bit about the book and when it's going to come out?
Yeah. So it's basically a book, 300 pages or so, that, like I mentioned before, is divided into sections on understanding the gut, the physiology, why symptoms happen, and then a third on nutrition, carbohydrate, fat, protein, sodium, fluid, training the gut, and then the last third's on psychology-based stuff. So. And then there's appendices where you look at medications and then gastrointestinal disorders. So there's kind of something for everybody, hopefully, that deals with those issues. Should be coming out late April, early May. You know, I'm selling it on my website, Velo Press. It's other places as well where you can get it. But yeah, I mean, I'm looking forward to coming out. I think it's a pretty needed resource. So I hope that, you know, athletes who struggle with those issues get some benefit out of taking a look.
I appreciated how well referenced it was. And as a practitioner in the field where I don't deal a lot with the, like the journals and the, you know, writing articles and things like that, and I have to blend both worlds on a day-to-day basis. 600 references?
About 700 now. Some 700? Of them are listed in multiple chapters, so it's probably a little bit less than 700.
Still
unique.
Though.
It's a lot.
You gave your indexer a workover.
Yeah. I don't know if they were happy with me with the number of references that I had. Yeah, can we cut back on the references?
That's a lot just of a little references. Bit. I mean,
that's a lot of pages to print.
That's two every page.
Yeah. I mean, it's
300
basically... 300-page
book.
It's a lot of pages to print for them. And I'm like, yeah, but we can cut back a little bit. Yeah.
No, I see, in all seriousness, I appreciate how well researched it was.
I appreciate that. Yeah.
Good job on that.
So yeah, I mean, it's very science-based, but I try and make it, you know, entertaining enough to read for the person who, you know, doesn't live and die in science. You know, if you're not the type of person who needs to have a scientific explanation for everything, hopefully there'll still be some good practical stuff, practical stuff.
All right, where can people find you on social? If you want people to find you on social.
Oh, God, you're going to ask me to remember my social media handle. It's SportsRDPhD, I think, something to that effect.
Just Google it. People
just Google
find.
It. Yeah. Athletesgut.com, theathletesgut.com. You can check out the reviews. You can buy the book there. Learn a little bit about my research.
And it's going to come out when?
So I think it starts shipping from Velo Press in late April, and then a lot of the other places you'd find it, it says May 12th, I think, is the release date.
Cool. Patrick, thank you for your time. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, cool. It's great to be here.
Yeah.
Glad to be on the podcast.
Awesome, man.
Thanks.
All right, trail runners, what did you think? I thought that was a really interesting conversation, full of a lot of practical knowledge that you can kind of take out on the trails and into your training sessions this week, maybe even later on this month. I really appreciate Patrick for coming on the podcast with us today. The book that he wrote is just going to end up being a really valuable resource for a whole lot of athletes. Like I said, on the onset, it's laid out really well in a completely practical way that even if you have no nutrition background, you're going to really understand what's going on. So thanks to Patrick. Thanks to our mutual publishers, VeloPress, AKA Pocket Outdoor Media, which is what they're known as now, for connecting us and getting me an advanced copy of the book. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it very much. Thank you guys for listening. If you have not had the opportunity to do so, go ahead and give this podcast a rating on iTunes. It helps the show out a lot. Coming up, I am going to be out at Lake Sonoma in about a month's time. I'll be taking your questions from the mobile recording studio. So be sure to stop by, check it out, say hi, get a question entered that I can bring up in a future edition of the podcast. I've already got a ton of those already loaded up, and I'm trying to compile them into some kind of reasonably flowing discussions that that have some common threads of knowledge that we can disperse amongst the audience here. So thank you guys for listening. I hope to see you guys out on the trail soon. And yeah, we'll see you on the trails, people.